Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Professor Peter Fleming from Bristol University's talk up at the Save Redland Library campaign, their evening on dissent. His books, A.J. Pollard's Imagining Robin Hood, with a very different version of what we've been handed down about who Robin Hood was, published in 2004, and Johan Huizinga, the Dutch historian, on The Waning of the Middle Ages, published way back in 1919, his favourite books. Also, Eric Walker, who does a distribution firm called Concord Films of anti-nuclear and peace films based in Ipswich. He's critical of a church service at Westminster Abbey, a thanksgiving for 50 years of British nuclear weapons, at odds with the church's policy and Jesus's teachings. And also, Rodney Shakespeare has a website and a book on something called binary economics. What is binary? Well, there's two different things that generate wealth. One is the ownership of the machinery, and the other is the labour. Rodney spells it out and explains why zero-hours contracts are never going to be revoked, and that is the way for the future until there's a crash. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Thanks, Lloyd. Thanks for the invitation. My main book is A.J. Pollard's Imagining Robin Hood. And I'll talk about Pollard and Robin Hood. Well, I'm going to talk about Robin Hood now, and A.J. Pollard I'll talk about in a minute. Robin Hood is perhaps, apart from King Arthur, the most widely disseminated, I suppose, literary figure from the Middle Ages in English. He's all over the place in current popular culture, certainly. He was the son and heir of the Earl of Huntingdon, dispossessed of his lands and title. He took from the rich and gave to the poor, defended the Saxons against their Norman overlords, lived in the reign of Richard I, the Lionheart, loved Maid Marian, was of Nottinghamshire, and had Friar Tuck as one of his followers, except he wasn't originally any of these things. In the earliest written tales of Robin Hood, all of which are found from the 15th century and early 16th century, in the 100 years before the Henrician Reformation of the 1530s. He's the leader of a group of outlaws, his merry men, not afraid to use often extreme violence. The Sheriff of Nottingham is killed by the merry men twice in the tales of Robin Hood. And while the Sheriff was evil, although in the extant tales we're not told why he was evil, a perfectly innocent young squire is also murdered by Robin Hood and his merry men. And he preys on those who happen to stray into the forest. But it is usually the forest of Barnsdale in Yorkshire, rather than Sherwood Forest near Nottingham, that features in the tales. He takes from the rich, because they have money, but he doesn't give to the poor. He keeps their riches for himself, or redistributes them to his merry men, not to the poor. Robin's passion is for the Virgin Mary. This is before the Reformation, remember. This is when England was Catholic, rather than Maid Marian. So his passion is for the Virgin Mary rather than Maid Marian. And he has an animus against monks, especially, particularly those from the Benedictine Abbey of St. Mary's in York. The Robin Hood that we think we know the Robin of TV, film, etc., is largely the product of the later 16th century and beyond, from the 17th to the 19th centuries. The Nottingham connection, the dalliance with Maid Marian, the acceptance of Friar Tuck, and above all, the tale of a dispossessed nobleman who fights against the Norman yoke for the sake of his fellow Saxons in the reign of Richard the Lionheart, are all products of this later post-medieval period. In the earliest written tales of Robin Hood that A.J. Pollard, Tony Pollard, not to be confused with the TV archaeologist of the same name, concentrates on in his 2004 book, Imagining Robin Hood, it's basically the earliest written tales, so the tales of Robin Hood from the mid-15th to the early 16th century. Tony Pollard is Emeritus Professor of History at Teesside University, Middlesbrough, although he was born and brought up in Somerset and went to Bristol University. In his well-written book, and it is well-written, it reads like a novel, please get this book through the library, through the excellent library service, etc. In this well-written book, Tony maintains that Robin and his merry men were yeoman foresters, sort of superannuated gamekeepers. And as such, tales of them were likely to appeal to both the gentry and aristocracy, as well as the lower ranks of society. This theory, which is well explained in the book, was first aired in an article which Tony wrote with Richard Armand in 2001. While this view of Robin may be seen to be conservative, conformist even, Tony Pollard concludes that there was something subversive about Robin Hood and his merry men, originally subversive. No matter how good the king was, and in the earliest tales, we are told that Robin lived during the early years of the reign of Edward III, the hero of the battles of Crecy and Poitiers against the French, not during the reign of Richard the Lionheart, the king is only mortal and will die and be replaced eventually by a bad king, as indeed Edward III was, in that he was replaced, having grown old and senile, in 1377 by his grandson, Richard II, who was deposed in 1399 and killed the next year. Pollard's English kings are thus like King Arthur, in that the greatest king ever, albeit again like Richard, like Robin the Hood, imaginary, is bound to fail. Robin Hood was then, according to Tony Pollard, all things to all men and women, both a loyal subject, albeit one who exchanges life at court after he's pardoned and accepted into the royal household, for the life of a forest outlaw, and thus likely to appeal to the upper ranks, and also a subversive dissident, likely to appeal to the lower ranks of society. That's, I think, all I have to say about the book. So,
and that was Professor Peter Fleming, his first book from Bristol University at the Save Redland Library campaign. That was his book, A.J. Pollard's Imagining Robin Hood, published in 2004. Then it's Johann Heutzinger, The Waning of the Middle Ages, published in 1919.
Thank you, Lloyd. My wild card is this book by Johann Heutzinger called, in one translation, The Waning of the Middle Ages. Is anyone in the audience Dutch or speaks Dutch? No, OK. Well, in that case, I can say quite deliberately and concisely that Johann Heutzinger is his name, And this translation was by Fritz Hopman in 1924 into English. But it was published in Dutch by Johan Huizinga in 1919 in as Hörstil der Middeleeuwen, which means, well, a better translation, actually, is the autumn of the Middle Ages rather than the waning of the Middle Ages. However, the Dutch-born historian Carl Joachim Weintraub dismissed Hopman's translation as a very inferior, crippled version of the original. But nonetheless, it was assigned as a required text in many universities. Until a translation came out in 1996 by Peyton and Mamich, which isn't actually a translation of the original. It's a translation of a German version which was never published. Anyway, I won't go into the details of this. Nevertheless, Hopman's translation, this copy that I've got in my hand, captures the essence, I think, of the original. Huizinga was concerned with the history of France and the Netherlands, particularly the Burgundian court in the 14th and 15th centuries. Now, the Burgundian court in the Netherlands was basically Flanders and the area now known as Belgium and so on. Very, very important economically to the rest of Europe and to England. But it was the history of France and northern France and the Burgundian court seen through the eyes of one Huizinga, who was insistent that history should be literature rather than science. So this book reads well as literature, even in this supposedly bad translation. And also, Huizinga said that history should be concerned with culture, defined more widely than elite culture, but not so wide as anthropological or archaeological culture. And here, with particular reference, here in this book, with particular reference to the visual arts, notably the paintings of the Van Eycks, Jan van Eyck particularly. Huizinga was not, however, a trained art historian, nor indeed primarily trained as a research historian. His first studies were in languages. This book is largely concerned, therefore, with printed sources rather than with archival sources. The book, certainly in Hopman's translation, may be an example of a truly great work of history that is, at the same time, almost entirely wrong in its interpretation. It seeks to disavow Jacob Burckhardt's thesis, translated into English in 1860 as the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, that there was a northern Renaissance. While there's nothing wrong, intrinsically wrong with this, and Burckhardt might himself fall into the category of a great historian whose work is riddled with errors, Huizinga has been criticised for treating this period of the 14th and 15th centuries as static, that there were no changes in the course of 200 years, and particularly that no changes took place in the period before. And Huizinga has also been criticised for focusing on the upper ranks of Burgundian courtly society. He was aware that he focused on the elite and largely ignored the majority of society, but he still did it. He was out of step with the main tenets of Western historiography from the 1950s onwards. He died in 1945. But it will be interesting to see if his work stands up better to criticism in the 21st century, when many of these tenets, based ultimately on Marxist terms have been rejected by most historians. I just want to read you the first bit of Heusinger's chapter one, which is on the violent tenor of life. And this chapter really sets the scene for what is to come and contains a it's famous to those who know it, opening line in this paragraph. To a world when it was half a thousand years younger, the outlines of all things seemed more clearly marked than to us. The contrast between suffering and joy, between adversity and happiness, appeared more striking. All experience had yet to the minds of men the directness and absoluteness of the pleasure and pain of child life. Every event, every action, was still embodied in expressive and solemn forms, which raised them to the dignity of a ritual. For it was not merely the great facts of birth, marriage, and death, which, by the sacredness of the sacrament, were raised to the rank of mysteries. Incidents of less importance, like a journey, a task, a visit, were equally attended by a thousand formalities, benedictions, ceremonies, formulas. So that's all I want to say about the making of the Middle Ages. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Eric Walker. My wife and I, we originally started what was called the Nuclear Disarmament Newsreel Committee back in 1958. And we're both Quakers, and after a while of making films, we then decided to buy, but we realised we were not good filmmakers. There were many excellent films, so we started buying films to hire out to schools and protest groups, etc. And gradually we were asked to take on other films, so we took on film classics to do with changing childcare in hospitals. We persuaded the BBC. At that time, the BBC never released any of their programmes for use on 16mm film, but we persuaded them to let us have Cassie Come Home, you know, the film about the homeless, which kick-started the charity called Shelter. In fact, we kick-started quite a lot of movements. 1975, we had the first film connected with fair trade, a film about conditions on tea plantations. Also, around about that time, we started releasing films about climate change, which in those days, of course, they used the word ecology. So, in fact, Concord kick-started quite a few different movements by supplying films for use. In those days, there was no video. It was 16mm films.
Okay, so you're based in Ipswich. I understand you've got an office there. How many films are there that you rent out around the country?
Well, of course, things have changed. We don't rent them out as films nowadays. Video cassettes came in and we rented them. Then, of course, it became DVD. We stopped renting because it's easy to make a copy of a DVD and we couldn't afford to rent a film for £1 or £2 and people make a copy, because that would have soon put us out of business. We couldn't afford to buy new programs. But now, with video on demand, you know, things like Netflix Netflix and so on, we've got our own video on demand system. So if people look on our website, sometimes they will see that they can hire a program to look at for about, you know, anything between £1 and £2.50.
Eric, how many different films have you got? Because you must have an incredible archive there going back to the 1950s.
Yes, we've got about 1,500 different films.
Can I ask you what your favourites are? One or two favourites?
We don't hire it out so much now because the BBC sell it themselves. But the film of which we had the most copies was The War Game. We had The War Game when it had been banned on television, but we persuaded the BBC to let us have it as a 16mm film, and we used to have about 120 copies in circulation.
Well, what is that film?
You've never heard of The War Game? The War Game, it was made by Peter Watkins. It was so horrific about the effects of a nuclear bomb attack on Britain. BBC commissioned it, and then they refused to show it. The government, in fact, put pressure on them not to show it, because it was made right about the time that the CND campaign was at its height. And frankly, if that film had been shown, there would have been so much pressure on the government to stop having nuclear weapons that they would have had to have given up.
Any other films that you've circulated around? I know it's a bit unfair to ask you for favourites, but ones that you actually still can enjoy watching again and again?
Yeah, well, then most of them are not films you enjoy watching because they're not amusement. We've got a lot of films to do with childcare. Nowadays, we're not just on nuclear issues, but on all sorts of issues of social concern. We've got films about aggression. But the films of which we've probably over the 50 years have sold the most are, and they're still bought today, we had an order in only a couple of days ago from a Japanese university, a series of films about children being taken into care on a short-term basis and the effect it has on their lives. And although these films are old, they still sell all over the world.
Okay, I'm going to pin you down, though. I want the title of another film, which is one of your favourite films, Eric.
It's called Young Children in Brief Separation, John. This particular one, John, who goes into a residential children's home, which is a disaster for him. The other ones are about children going into foster homes for short periods.
I mean, I know you've got a lot of films about nuclear weapons, and I wonder, you know, you probably are old enough to remember the 1950s, and maybe you could tell us what was going on in the 50s and 60s.
The most relevant at the moment to do with this terrible, in my opinion, hypocritical business of a service at Westminster Abbey to commemorate using the threat, being prepared to use nuclear weapons in defence. We've got one film called The Megatron Bomb, A Guide to Armageddon, which using British and American government statistics and research shows what would happen if a one megaton bomb, which is 16 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, by the way, if it was dropped over St. Paul's, about the devastation, complete devastation in a circle, which would include Battersea. And Battersea is a long way from St. Paul's. And then another film that we've just re-released, it's a very old one, so the quality is not so good. It's called John Hersey's Hiroshima. John Hersey was an American journalist, and he visited Hiroshima a few months after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and he interviewed some of the survivors. And he was a journalist for the New Yorker magazine, and the editors were so shocked by what they read that they scrapped the normal contents and just put the whole book into the New Yorker magazine.
This service, which is happening today or planned to happen, there are actually 200 clerics in Britain who have signed a letter saying that it should not happen. They've called on the Dean of Westminster to urgently reconsider a planned national service of thanksgiving for Britain's nuclear weapons. Yeah. And the statement has been coordinated by something called Christian CND.
Yes, I'm not surprised. I mean, Jesus Christ, if people remember, was rather a pacifist. I know he wasn't completely peaceful because he overturned the tables in the temple of the moneylenders and traders, but he was certainly not a warlike person. And he was, and the first Christians, of course, were pacifists.
This service is there to bless, if you can use that word, 50 years of Britain's continuous at-sea deterrent. And yeah, that is 50 years of having nuclear weapons at sea. I just wonder if this is actually what they're saying, is that nuclear weapons have kept the peace.
That's a question it's impossible to answer, isn't it, when you think about it? How can you know whether it was nuclear weapons that kept the peace? You can't prove it either way. Because we have peace, it doesn't mean to say that it was nuclear weapons that stopped it. In fact, there's been, I understand, that there have been two occasions when orders were given to submarine commanders, both to Russian and to American, and the submarine commanders refused to carry out the orders, send off rockets.
Well, what were those occasions then?
One was during the Cuba missile crisis. I don't have the exact details. It might be worth Googling it to find out.
The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament has said it's going to hold protests outside the Abbey today. Yeah. And will perform a die-in to represent the victims of nuclear warfare.
Yeah.
But, Eric, at the end of the day, surely the Dean of Westminster Abbey can do exactly what he wants. If he wants to have a service which is working with the armed forces, then surely that's a good thing. The armed forces and the church need to be close, don't they?
Well, I'm not sure who would have made the decision. I always thought, I don't know much about the structure of the Church of England, but you have a dean and you have a chapter, and this dean is... Incidentally, of course, one of the founders of CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, was the Dean of St. Paul's. He was a leading figure, the Dean of St. Paul's.
So why do you say that the teachings of Jesus are against nuclear weapons? Because nuclear weapons are just a part of life nowadays.
Well, I'm afraid so is drug taking, but it doesn't mean to say we approve of it.
And what signal do you think this service, if it goes ahead, what signal does it send to the wider world?
I think it'll tell you what a load of hypocrites. I mean, let's face it. I mean, they aren't our own nuclear weapons anyway. They're American. And it's very disputed as to how much say we have in the use of them.
Well, surely this is an independent nuclear deterrent in these Royal Navy submarines.
In theory, lots of things are said, but it doesn't mean to say because someone says something that it is so.
How do people find Concord Media online nowadays then?
All they need to do is to type into Google on Concord Media as one word, concordmedia.org.uk.
Eric Walker, thanks very much.
Right, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hello, I am Rodney Shakespeare, and perhaps the key information about me is that I am a binary economist. And binary economics, and the website is binaryeconomics.net, is a new paradigm economics. And that what that means is that its underlying assumptions are completely different from those of conventional economics, be it right-wing economics, middle-of-the-road economics, or left-wing economics. Indeed, binary economics challenges 59 of the assumptions which lie under conventional economics.
Now, let me just stop you there, Rodney, because we've had on this program a chap called Professor Steve Keen, and he's talked about something, he describes something similar as a Copernican revolution is necessary in economics. And what he means by that is that Copernicus was the one who was pilloried for proposing that the Earth rotated around the sun, orbits around the sun, rather than the sun orbiting around the Earth. And this, of course, was then proven true. He believes the same sort of thing is going in economics, where there's some absolutely fundamental mistakes have been made across literally thousands, if not tens of thousands, of academics, and that are hardwired into economics courses that young people get at school and university.
That is right, and Steve Keen is right. And in the main textbook on binary economics, we do pages and pages on Copernicus, because he, in fact, is the classic example of something where he overthrew all the paradigmatic assumptions that were prevalent at his time. And as a result, he opened up the new world of science and rocketry and all sorts of things.
But I mean, we're living in the modern world now. If someone was to propose something like that, surely the financial press, Horizon on the BBC, everybody would be onto it and say, crikey, we've got this wrong.
What they do, they always start by ignoring, and then they attack. And it's only when events are so bad that people are forced to make the change that they come to see the new paradigm. I mean, I've written another book on this, and I've taken lots of examples. I mean, Darwin, for example, they all understand that when there's a big paradigmatic change, at first it is ignored, and then it is attacked. And binary economics has been ignored. It's now being attacked, but its time will only come when events force the change. You see, you cannot win a paradigm argument by argument and debate, because the assumptions of the people you're talking to, they understand everything in terms of the old assumptions and the old paradigm. Old economics, left wing, right wing, center of the road, is based upon 59 false assumptions. You can find those assumptions at binaryeconomics.net. And when you look at them, all you have to do is look at each assumption and say, what is the opposite?
Okay, well, look, we don't have time to go through all 59 assumptions now, but can you just pick out one or two and explain some fundamental things that you think that economists have got wrong?
Crux of the matter. Think of a man carrying a heavy sack on his shoulder, a sack of wheat, and he carries it perhaps for 1 mile and he's exhausted. Give him a donkey and he puts two sacks on and goes for 5 miles. Now, that is 10 sack miles. Give him a horse, 4 sacks and 10 miles in a day, and that's 40 sack miles. Give him a road and a lorry, and it's 200 sacks for 200 miles, that's 40,000. Now, that is a little illustration of what has happened and is happening in the world in terms of productive capacity. The increase is absolutely massive. And yet at the same time, you're finding that ordinary people are not getting the benefit of that potential. And so the existing system, first of all, it assumes that only labor creates the wealth. Well, labor is rather important, but in fact, it is the capital instruments which are doing now, generally, most of the creation.
So you're talking about machines and robots, that sort of thing?
You are talking machines, you are talking technology, you are talking robots. And it's true in every single field. I just use transportation, but in agriculture now, one man will produce massive amounts, shall we say, of wheat, again, is the example, which was produced by 100 people today. And yet in this world, 55% of the world live on under $3 a day. And if you now look at the UK, the real incomes of the sort of the middle and the working classes have been going backwards for the last 10 years. In America, the real incomes of the middle classes are going backwards for nearly 25 years. And you see, it is that phenomenon of loss of real income combined with the insecurity which comes from the technological shift to the production going on to more automated processes, et cetera, that you end up with temporary jobs, part-time jobs, now, the gig economy.
Yes, you're right. I mean, 0 hours contracts, all this stuff. But let me drag you back, I'm afraid, to your 59 points that you think are wrong. Can we have just one or two economic basics that you think are fundamentally wrong, please?
Here we go. Number one will be that labour creates all the wealth. Now, Adam Smith said that, but 23 years after Adam Smith, a Frenchman, Jean-Baptiste Say, realised that Adam Smith had got it wrong, and he said the whole of Smith is wrong. But today, we are still told that labour creates the wealth, and that propaganda means that most people will end up being prevented from having a proper connection to the capital instruments, which really do create the wealth. Binary economics ensures that you can labour, if you can labour, and at the same time, all of every individual has a connection to capital assets. You get two ways of truly producing, and hence two ways of being truly productive and able to consume. The point there is, there is no solution in conventional economics from now on. They are not going to be able to solve it. And here, let me address the question of the generation of clean electricity. You are told that money must always be lent to you for something or other at 15% compound or 20% compound. But money, and you're talking 95% of the money supply, is actually created by the banking system. And it does two things. It adds an administration charge for work done, which is fair. But then its ability to create money just means that the banking system and those who have access to this source of money can essentially end up sucking up the money and the wealth. In binary economics, you can use national bank, interest-free, repayable and cancelable loans to put into, shall we say, in this example, capital projects at half the cost, at a third the cost, or one quarter of the existing cost. And I'll take two examples. You could do that for social housing, or you can do it for tidal barrages. Now, tidal barrages or tidal lagoons, you can have them right the way around the UK. You won't need many of them. And they are old technology. They're walls with turbines in them. And the tide goes in and out twice over 24 hours. Clean and marvellous technology. And we could have all our electricity done like that. But they don't do it. They're shutting down one at the moment outside Cardiff. Probably across from you, Tony, in Bristol, the other side of the Bristol Channel. I think they're stopping that on the grounds it's too expensive. And it is too expensive. By the time the thing is built with money at 15 or 20% compound, the price has rocketed off and can never be repayable. Use your national bank at an interest-free loan and an administration cost of 0.25%. And the money goes out. It creates the thing. And it is paid back out of the earnings of the thing.
Well, when you say binary, that means two, doesn't it? What does binary economics actually mean? What are these two things?
It means composed of two. And what it means is that there are two ways by which wealth is produced. Adam Smith, he said only labour creates wealth. And he took the example of his a manufactory, which was a pins. But every single piece of work making the pins was actually done by hand. It was hand, which is the Latin for hand. place. And he had some understanding that the capital assets, the great machinery of the future, was coming into being, but he couldn't quite see it. But all our assumptions on this key matter go back to Adam Smith.
Okay, now look, all this theorising might actually, some people might find it a bit difficult. How does it translate into things like people who are now forced onto zero-hour contracts? That is to say, effectively, this is a form of slave labour, actually, where you will work for somebody, but totally on their terms. So they may not actually give you any work in a given week, so you may get zero pay. I mean, this is actually what economics has boiled down to today. So can you try and, let's come back down to ground level here. What are zero-hours contracts, and is there any chance that people could get onto a better contract?
At this moment, there is no chance. The situation of those zero-hours contracts, those part-time, those temporary, those unpaid internships, that is the phenomena which is there now and is increasing. Binary economics is not and cannot be a quick a wave of the hand solution. It actually takes time to build these new holdings into the hands of people, because they are not just handouts of money. What they are is they enable the building of productive capacity in the hands of people over time. And I tell you, as each tranche of this happens, it takes 5 to 7 years before you start to get the thing working. Because, you see, it is a fundamental paradigm, a new economics. But there is no short-term solution to it now. And to answer your question, binary economics provides a long-term solution and a very powerful solution, but it cannot, at this moment, actually solve the situation of those who are being screwed into the ground on top of their student debt, their inability to buy a place at the huge house prices. They are on 0 hours contracts, 3 hours this week, 30 next week, 10 the next week, none the fourth week, and all that stuff.
Yes, this insecure labour is a real worry, and it's actually a plague in our modern society. I do worry that we had a massive bailout back in 2008 of the banks that caused the crisis in the first place. They got nearly £1 trillion of public money, and yet people are being cut back on social security, for example, on food banks, desperate for an income. And it seems that some of this has translated in France into protests on the streets. I wonder if you'd agree that that is one of the things at the roots of the yellow vest protests.
Take a long-term view, and what you saw in 2008 was the sort of the first crack in of basically the massive build-ups of debt, in personal debt, corporation debt, government debt, student debt, in country after country. Now, the levels of debt in 2008 are now higher than what it was in 2008, right the way around the world. And so what you're going to get is another and much more fundamental crack. 2008 was just the start of what would be a massive, huge crack.
Well, I know at the time that it was called the crash. It's now referred to by people like Robert Peston as the crash. Actually, it wasn't a crash. I wonder if you'd agree. I mean, it seems to me it was much more just a bailout of the banks and effectively the biggest heist in history. The banks walked away with hundreds of billions of public money.
It was the big heist, but you see, the point about the binary attack on the banks here is the banks do not use their money creation's ability to put productive capacity into the hands of the mass of the population over time. All that they do is to put it into the hands of a narrow elite who cannot spend all their income. And that is why that's another of the fundamental assumptions, which is that the economy is free and it is fair and it is efficient. It isn't. It concentrates productive capacity in the hands of the few, and the rich can never ever spend their income.
And I wonder, is there any relation between the impoverishment of the lowest 9/10 of society and these protests in France? Do you think the yellow vests? Because we see this every week now. People out on the streets in France are simply not having it.
If you look at the French situation, you can see that the first people at the core of the yellow vests are not unionized people. They are those, first of all, who use their car for going for a few hours work here and a few hours work there. They were all in insecure work, part-time work, temporary work. The more unionized people are starting to show and to take part in France, but they still think that they're relatively secure. They haven't quite woken up to it, though they're waking up to it. Those in the banlieue, in the social housing estates, they've given up any hope of having employment at all. But the ones who are sort of showing you where the problem is are the yellow vests. And it's that same phenomena which led to the combination of the five-star movement and the Lega Nauta in Italy. I happened to be in Venice about 4 years ago, a very rich area. And yet it was absolutely astonishing how the phenomenon that I'm talking about, I don't speak Italian, but it was being translated for me, was going on in what you thought was a prosperous area. Next thing you know, it's the Lega Nauta is strong in the area. Tony, this is going on right the way across the board, and there is no solution to it. There is no quick solution to it in binary economics, I'm afraid.
Okay, so whereabouts do you think we're heading then?
We're heading very soon to a, I can't tell you exactly when, but the next and worst part of the crash coming. And Steve Keen agrees with it. Steve Keen is a very original thinker. And his analysis actually says the same. He doesn't, if I may say so, have the extent of the remedies which lie in binary economics. But both binary economics and Steve Keen, we say that the great feature of this is this build-up of debt. Debt is now becoming unrepayable, and that's going to lead to another crash. I'm afraid that will be having nasty political consequences. So there you are. Steve Keen has got it right. The debt is becoming unrepayable. The fault is a system which does everything on the assumption that jobs will always be sufficient or welfare benefit. And it's not true. You've got this phenomenon now of plenty of jobs, low-paid, insecure. I mean, look at the Brexit people. They want Singapore on Thames. And as for look at France, Macron, all he can do is to, in fact, promise some sort of little extra tax relief. But he can't solve the problem of the insecurity and the low-paid jobs and the growing gap between rich and ordinary people.
I mean, certainly a crash, the 1929-style crash today would probably be a lot worse because the governments are simply not... I mean, we had Roosevelt and the New Deal after that. The governments are just simply not in the powerful position enough to do the sorts of big changes that were necessary after 1929. But I wonder how seriously you take the former Bank of England governor, Mervyn King, Rodney, because he had an article in the Daily Mail back in February last year, 2018, where he said there is a $166 trillion debt time bomb, that's what he called it, and it will trigger the next financial meltdown. And this is the former Bank of England governor. He's not some Johnny No Friends in the street. He's someone who was right at the apex of the Bank of England of the pound and the banking system appointed by Gordon Brown.
Mervyn King is right. And under Mervyn King, there was also another revelation. People like Steve Keen and I and other binary economists, we understand that money is created by the banking system. It's not somebody else's money that's being lent. And I tell you that because it was the Bank of England under Mervyn King, which actually admitted at last that is the truth of the matter. See, another of the assumptions of the 59 you have to grasp is precisely that the money which is lent is actually created by pressing computer buttons. The argument is, when the banks do this, they're serving the purposes of a free economy. which results in efficient results and fair results, and all the outcomes are fair. And so if you've got no money or you've got an insecure job, it's all your fault. It's just not true. The system and its assumptions end up concentrating the new productive capacity in the hands of the rich. And as a result, and the rich can never, ever spend all their income.
So now, this $166 trillion is a lot of money. It's much more than I could ever imagine, and I don't think I've ever heard any such figure ever mentioned, for example, by most of the financial press. £166 trillion debt overhang. That's what Mervyn King says, and he says it's going to be the biggest crash in history once this debt starts to become clear that this is unpayable, because at the moment those debts are being serviced on a small level. But what I'm trying to say here is it does seem that the people with the wealth are using that wealth to acquire much more wealth all the time. Yes. And those maybe the 99% at the bottom of the pile are simply being driven further and further into debt slavery, Rodney.
Well, that is precisely the point. And the productive capacity, which we are calling wealth, lies in the hands of the rich. And you can never ever have a truly balanced free market economy, for that matter, because all the productive capacity is concentrated in the hands of the rich. $170 trillion. That is the debt. But also there's a very similar figure, or even higher figure, for the derivative contracts. The whole thing is tottering. I can't tell you when it's going to collapse. But all the alternative economists who prophesied what was going to happen in 2008, they could see it coming and they got it right. All those same economists are now, and Steve Keen was one of them, are now saying there is another big crash coming. It's been put off because the governments have essentially bailed out, as you have said, Tony.
Okay, so if you were in the seat of Philip Hammond right now and you could make just one change, what would that be, Rodney?
I'll tell you what it would be. It would be you would use the National Bank of the UK to immediately issue interest-free loans for two things which would capture the minds of the public. Number one, I would go for tidal lagoons or tidal barrages and say, we're going to generate all our electricity and we're going to do these barrages at a quarter of the existing cost so that we can do it. That is the climate solution there, number one. And number two, I would say our housing is an absolute disgrace. We can have social housing done at half, a third, or a quarter of the cost, which is done at the moment by borrowing money from the banking system at 15 or 20%. I would do those two things because they are easy to understand. The other things are much more difficult to understand and have more complicated.
But you know
mechanisms.
What, Rodney? I think if you were to do those two things, build houses and tidal lagoons, people would see the benefits rather quickly and start to be asking you, okay, what next? Anyway, Rodney Shakespeare, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Can you just repeat your website again, please?
Yes. Okay. Well, go to binaryeconomics.net and there you can find information about these matters.
Thanks, Rodney. Brilliant. Fascinating. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectsradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Professor Peter Fleming at the Save Redland Library Dissenters launch, Eric Walker from Concord Films in Ipswich, and Rodney Shakespeare from Binary Economics. Also, thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you've got some spare time, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Bloody war.